Imbolc, a new season. My mother's winter's womb, goodbye. It hasn't been an easy passage. See, unquiet in a pitch of nighttime shots and shockings. Take and eat me, glut of light. Take and eat me, glut of light. Display me in your bare-assed honesty. Here I come, reaching the small gap like a spear, hand and leg before me. She screams, I am her pain. Inside her, everywhere, I met a challenge. Wall became wall of mirrors, faces I couldn't read, and not a shred of scent to tell me was I lamb or you or what, but a hard desire. Rampant, ringed by stairs, I bucked, butted, gashed myself, got hooked on sheer fight. She broke, toppled my home. Now who's the lamb? I raise my head and wail once for the lost season, but no regret. I never planned the wreckage. Her body started it, not mine. However much she hates me, I must stand upon my splayed legs and learn to bound. Begin. Begin always, a poet said. But how? Californians and shamans erase history, or so they claim. Slow thought to a wide motion. Begin again and die. The man believed his scuppered prostate cursed. The woman's lymph declined. Marisa left the convent, chasing sex and family. Innocent, deceived, succumbed to uterine cancer. By 45, the clock wound down. Land ahoy! And there's the nerve to jump and run, shivered in the lower deck, jaded by what it's been. Scan the heart, find a picture in the brain. Scan the brain, find history and the lie of substance. I have repeated in the close night that the past is oneself and I another. Fought the dark team that steals the show. You, it goes. You, Judas. Your lips. Your lips were needy for something practical. That's dreams. I drove you home. That's dreams too. Your lips sucked me towards you always. I was for you. Stuck on those soft flesh ridges. Wanting to. So to fall. We had, you'd have called it sex, signals happening between us. But you blinked and I gulped, froze the curling wave, hoarded the slide of your fingers and the desert peaks of your breasts. Your lips, by which words were formed like, let's say, pearls, were not precious, except to me, who wore them for the down there feel, the all over buzz. I meant it when I asked you to bed. You laughed and said you'd dreamed us doing it. That's when I knew how others felt, for once. You tease. Now we're estranged. Your face still pops. Were you a true, well, love, whether or not, no regrets, because this, your lips, was not to be missed. I'd like to do a couple of poems that are kind of, I suppose, imaginative, expressionistic take on what would be considered disorders. Borderline. Don't do yourself a violence, the teacher says. What self? Says the girl with the knife. And which possessor? Am I the hand that holds the knife, or the motor neurons that hold the hand? Am I the pretty pink cheeks, or the shitting buttocks, the vulva that transports, or the ponderous humps between which the heart rides to exhaustion? Preserve yourself, the priest says. In a jar, says the girl. I might survive, but pickle stings. That's why, she slices, I do this, so I can bleed into the brain that binds. It's a kind of love to want to dissolve, and a kind of hate that keeps you striking for yourself in a world so borderless. Stand up for yourself, the counselor says. I have tried without success, the girl replies, pressed to the flowers of a blood-stained carpet, to find a stalk that holds, that daily reassures me of its rootedness and depth. Even now, this carpet flies me off to a place of chaos that, open as a blasted rock, exposes me to every wind. You're a social man, warm, intelligent, composed. Jitters when she would walk in uptight. Bent on a career in IT management and getting married. With the look that meant, oh hell, it was all. You know how to fly. That moment when the helicopter, the down collars again, because he was drinking, can be moved with just a thought, thrills your core. And she couldn't just move on. You craved her smile. But you're shelving all that, because after all, in this climate, just that slice of sweetness and the feminine colours, you'll have to save. So you're giving up the apartment on Hangard. Her smile too, when she played with you. And moving in with that wonderful girl who's so together, her shoulder by yours for your favourite shows, and doesn't want that lavish wedding that's almost de rigueur, even if nothing went in. You enjoy films, eating out, good music of all kinds, and flying, which you think about every other moment. When your friends need you, you're there. You're wise. Because only then is this odd drumming in the chest. Don't get fazed by petty problems. Yes, your boss stilled. In dreams, you leave your body and scoot. Is somewhat rude, but you absorb his boorish ways. Unvesseled off to stunning landscapes, zestfully. Carry on. Your purpose can be served without a row. An eagle, or an albatross, or captain of a stealth mission. Purpose and service keep you in that one-track role. Come morning, as if the sun were one big dad's eye, you like so much, because life primarily must be steered. Clamps bite your muscles, you counsel yourself around the rapids, those shameful bursts of sheer, blind rage. Breathe deeply and try to think zen. In 1989, my partner, I, and our small son went to Belfast, mostly just to, in some way, become more aware or keep being aware of the situation in the north at the time. We didn't do a lot while we were there. We did kind of get a little bit involved in the community. I did with Women's News, which was the only feminist newspaper in Ireland at the time. We stayed there for a year, and in 1989, and as part of the whole process of, I suppose, trying to stay aware, I started to write a poem for every Easter. I think the only successful one of those was Easter 1989, but when the centenary came around, I thought I'd write another Easter poem, and this is called Easter 2016. In a house off the Falls Road in 1989, a Buddhist monk struck a gong and chanted grace. A teenage boy sniggered, and a nervous tabby nosed the saffron folds. The day before, the memorable sound was gunfire, and if there were prayers amid the random cracks, they took the veil of air and played dead about the serried windows. Buses billowed into storms of grey complexity from the bombed blazes of their guts. Outside a greengrocer's, an old woman braved the shots to rearrange her carrots and cabbage. 2016, Bereva Estate. I rise to a small sun sent from the obstructed horizon that casts a gold aura on the tall, chimneyless buildings. Three-bedroomed duplexes, ride apartments. No fires, neat solid fuel. It's a much sought-after area. Meet my neighbours, Christoph and Rebecca. We trust each other with nails. The scent of bergamot greets you when you call to deliver. Behind you, the pristine grass is bare. Yes, I own the orange Persian. She's not a stray, she just sits on the wrong mat. Sound insulation is close to perfect. Inside, you might as well be in Connemara or back in Beru's time in a monk's hut refitted with constant light, vaguely sensing the standing stone on the man-made mound in the centre of the closed cluster. Beauvale know how to do heritage. Thorkel, Dol Riada, Miletian Court, Quealdhove, lest we forego. Management is efficient. Litter is spiked daily by a brown-skinned man who smiles at his work. The red brick keeps its colour, cosy if crowded, a maze of content. I was greener than grass in a Lisburn chipper when I linked a Protestant dyke and asked for fish in my Republican tones. Two good reasons to die, she knew. She was always scrambling through the windows of married women, breached the barrier on the Donegal Road to court a Fenian with a carved black cat. I knew a Catholic artist, Drew King Billy, for UVF prisoners in Crumlin Road. It wasn't religion then, or when the IRA whipped his son for sniffing glue. I did nothing but live a while on the front line, my baby oblivious to the casual slant of a soldier's gun and shootings outside the rock bar. We scurried back south. Everywhere is north of somewhere. On a quiet beach, I wondered how to bear peace. I heard of sex between militants in an occupied house. Death is sexy, she told. But later, when the red has faded from the cloth, there you are, with a white sheet, like too much light. You seek the face, and it's white you find. The white of silence, of women on Xanax, of optimistic tree-interrupted streets, crystalline shopping meccas, scrubbed hotels in the cultural quarter. Flags are too flat for what they support. The miniature gardens of Bereva take me back to Rockmore Road. Lay a patio if you can't maintain the grass. Later, upgrade. The sage Persian can hide for hours among the stunted bushes, thinking them a jungle. You can learn to live anywhere, she purrs, having mounted the last wall of the estate, and returned. The boy with the bag of glue spent too long on the corner. When his parents split, he wasn't quite there when he put a noose over his head for whiteness. These days, I recall my granduncle, distant as the moon, member of the Cork Brigade. There's nothing so discreet we can say it's over, even if we never knew it, though new shops cut into the field can redraw the mental map in days. There's a greenish lane reminds me of country behind Airside Industrial Estate. Past the fancy nursing home, keep on to the dead end. The last house proclaims its privacy. And no, Bereva is not pronounced Beru, but his corpse was waked in the now Protestant church the night after the battle, white as a martial suit. I wrote a book called Savage Solitude, Reflections of a Reluctant Loner, which is what it says, really. Savage Solitude being a phrase from an Auden poem. And nobody's quite sure what it is, including myself. I mean, I say mixed genre. I thought of it as prose, but a lot of people describe it as poetry. It's in the mind-body-spirit section in my library, which is kind of interesting. And other people have described it as philosophy. So what I conceived it as was a study of solitude and how it plays out. And yes, the reluctance to be alone. This is not, sometimes it becomes to some extent a fairly contented solitude, but certainly for a lot of it, it's not very content. It's an internal conversation. So there are three voices. There's the voice of one, which is the kind of the positive voice of the unconscious, which is normally silent. Then there's the I voice, which is the supposedly determining self, the conscious self. And there's the voice of the other, and that's comprised of quotes from all sorts of sources. So one and I hear each other, but they don't hear the other. Equivocal. I've suddenly gone a bit coarse. I was in very good voice earlier.
That's good.
I have a drop here. Equivocal. One. They demand enthusiasm. They are totally involved. They speak passion and immersion. They love an other, a country, a subject, an activity. They plumb the eyes for something unequivocal. They will not find it. One pretends or retreats into familiar solitude. The other. I sit outside my own door for four seasons. I am tolerant of all weathers. I see the leaf go back to the ground. I am impartial to growth and death. Michael Hartnett, Doe 16. I. Life is less a passion than a plod. I've attempted to immerse myself, but floundered in lack of faith and insufficient fact. From where I stand, the options are multifarious, each too valid for exclusion. Involvement makes one forget oneself. Excessive involvement makes one forget the world. Unemployed. The other. The subjective can be so overemphasized that the individual's inner world becomes entirely divorced from reality. In that case, we call him mad. On the other hand, as Winnicott points out, the individual can suppress his inner world in such a way that he becomes overcompliant with external reality. If the individual regards the external world merely as something to which he has to adapt, rather than as something in which his subjectivity can find fulfillment, his individuality disappears and his life becomes meaningless or futile. Anthony Starr, Solitude. 1. When it appears that one is about to belong to an occupation or profession, one draws back. The assumption of an epithet, however praiseworthy, savours of loss. After the podium, one sees a high table and an incontrovertible way to hold a knife and fork. I. Before I'm a teacher, writer, carpenter, electrician, I'm a collection of physical and intellectual faculties. Functioning in commercial structures demands the translation of these into an occupation. You, however, are unemployable. In Ventures. 1. Bears are concepts. Tigers, documentaries. Mountains, Michael Palin and Joe Simpson. Little is touched that is physically dangerous. Instead, one delves and scrapes the bottom of this well, finding within its seamless wall quakes, marshes, a terrifying wormhole. The other. I complain that in life it is not as in the novel, where one has hard-hearted fathers and nisses and trolls to battle, and enchanted princesses to free. What are all such adversaries together compared with the pale, bloodless, tenacious of life, nocturnal forms with which I battle and to which I myself give life and existence? Soren Kierkegaard, Either Or. I. Kierkegaard was writing in the 1840s, when in other streams of experience, people were battling against hard-hearted landlords and the nisses and trolls of starvation. Liberty was often the enchanted princess. Can one complain of nocturnal forms when so many others are neither fed nor physically safe? Can one rummage in the internal when others can only think of their next meal? If I believed in a destined purpose, I might say that we do what we must. Desert. 1. A cold, white desert permeates all things, becomes one, keeps one nameless. It is stuck to the cornea, piled in the ears, caravaned to the backbone. The other. I speak of desert without repose, carved by relentless winds, torn up from its bowels, blinded by sands, unsheltered, solitary. André Chédid. Landscapes. I. We carry the world's phenomena as metaphors. They are part of us and we of them. Being thus of the mind, the white desert can't be escaped. But the mind's alchemy may transmute it. Sit. Let white be what white will. See if you die. Thank you. I'd like to just do some poems from my verse fantasy, which is called Parvet Evangelist. Now, it was inspired by the work of Pauline Buick, and I had written a poem with a yellow woman in it. I had this vision of a yellow woman, and then I happened to find a book of Pauline's paintings and thought, well, she's got a yellow woman as well. So I went to her and said, you've got a yellow woman. She says, no, I don't have a yellow woman, I've got a yellow man. So I asked her if she'd mind if I just did a bit of a treatment of her poems, or for her work, sorry, of her paintings, did poems on her paintings. So she was very helpful, and we discussed her work and discovered a grey man, yellow woman. And As the thinking progressed here, I originally had intended about 20 poems, but it became much bigger. So a story developed, and now it's 132 poems with 22 pulled aside, and a whole kind of worldview, a city, which I absolutely adored writing. But this is the pivotal picture. eventually, the eggshell woman and slate man. And for me, they represent Venus, Saturn, liberation, imprisonment. Pauline herself says that most of her paintings, or quite a lot of them, are to do with escape from this awful world, which I didn't quite relate to. I don't think it's an awful world, but I did relate to notions of liberation and imprisonment. Imprisonment has always fascinated me. So essentially, Parvat is the heroine, if you like, and Agilast is the city. Parvat having that implication of smallness, and Agilast meaning he does not laugh, or unlaughing. The city is made of slate, and it's four squares, so each poem is 16 lines long to represent that, but the poems take different shapes as well, even within the constraint of the 16 lines. Parvat, to begin with, is a conscious piece of matter, unshaped, unformed, unshaped piece of matter, hidden within one of the walls of the city of Agilast. She has three modes. She dreams, and when she dreams, she sees situations of imprisonment or difficulty in the world we know, the material world. And she wakes briefly, lying terrified beside the manic activity of Agilast, which never stops. And then in her other mode, she's transported outside of the city to become the spirit of liberation in the situations of imprisonment. I might say that Agilastians believe there's nothing beyond the city. They believe they're their own. It's Agilast, it's its own god, creates, recreates itself. So, Parvat. Pod. Agilast is never mute. Parvat, perched 10 micro urges from ground and sandwiched in the slate, is head and footered by a diligence of noise. Hammers, drills, mechanical cutters, blasts to excavate the stone. For 16 ergons down, devices hack and slice and pull ore from dense graves. Hauled through adits up to the urban edges, the gleanings are paraded through the city like an ant army's march home. Mind focus subverts vision. Ground on top, sky passive and vacant. Products ensue. Parvat tracks the industry to smelting plants and factories between the streets, then up the articulate towers to its commercial cry. She's a small, dissenting nerve in this saccadic brain, a feigning crush among the crannies of its folds, kinless in the adamant scrapings of an echoing pod, princess in the sour pulp of an inedible, imploding pea. This is one of the situations of imprisonment which Parvat visits as the spirit of liberation. And all of these situations are historical. This is to do with J.C. Dugard, who was abducted from her home at the age of 11 and kept a prisoner for 18 years in a small backyard shed. Mammy Longlegs. I named her Bianca, and I would talk to her. J.C. Dugard. You leave the ledge of terror by hiding underneath. Parvat spreads legs to the cracked wood, distilled. This body is a new Yukon, its far tips a golden dream. Who knows what's beyond the high knees or beneath? She can feel her extremities like wet lips pressed against a small input, birthing an instinctual map. She sees the girl at the edge of her compound eye. She has felt her delicate approach, her reverence. The child has learned her topography by how it hurts. He has blasted a long passage he mines without respite. She wishes she had no treasure to pull cruel pilgrims. Like this cleverly private insect, she names Bianca. The elegant tail, lucid wings, widely spread legs, are flourishes she might have made in a different skin. A cranefly lives to mate, but Parvit redesigns, becomes the trapped girl's pet, sterile mother in the silent shed. Because the Agelastians, encouraged and inculcated by the theocratic government, believe that there's nothing beyond the city, they have to make a major irrational act of thought in order to dispose of their waste, of which there's much. So as you can see, different all sorts of things arise in this book. Disposal. It's a kind of love. The city lifts its refuse to the wall and shoots it into the acquiescent unthinkable beyond. Cranes deliver to the tower tops where other cranes cast. It's a ritual, dipping at the high heaps, backing, turning, slow tips, rhythmic clanks, the reverent hum of engines. Households waste little. Penalties are too severe. Mostly it's dry tailings from the mines. Rocks overburden what was backfill before the city's underbelly grew clogged. Then there's the effluent, consequence of foreplay, build-up, close labour, presentation of gems. In the nethers, fluid is pneumatically pumped through the tight apertures of pipes to the same inexhaustible oblivion. Agelast is eternal present, fixed at its original 256 points, webbed in its own stirrings, self-raptured, webbed in its own stirrings, recycling them, sloughing off all stray concerns. There is no wasteland. And I'll finish with this one. This is essentially what Parvit wants to do. She sings within walls. She has a blue voice and sings gentian violet. She has a voice crimson and sunflower yellow. She strikes tones of orange wood, parquet, and laces them with 18 karat gold. Keys curve in on themselves and become eggs, whilst upward purple spirals climb utterly from her stemble limbs, her layers, her sharps twingling, her subsofts bristling. The grey ceiling marbles with her oh feel. White strings draw leaf green, catkin, nut brown, rose and peony. Until landscape she is a vast field of blossom, forgetting the hard earth that is never sure of water, that long forming substance that stops her being nothing. She sings within walls and becomes their out, their undoer, disclaims their every home. Thank you very much to O'Vale for asking me tonight. I really enjoy being here, and thank you very much.